KPCW News Time now, 8:14. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, members of Park City Leadership Class 23 returned from last week's City Road Tour last night. Three of those in the class join me now in the studio with their impressions of those 5 days. Thomas Horton is a photographer and teacher. Colleen McGinn is the aquatics director at the PC Mark. And Chris Neville is a software developer and business owner. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So, Tom, let's just start with you, and we'll run through the other two.
Great.
Just your impressions of Boulder and Blackhawk and Grand Junction, and I guess you had a stop in Vail as well, huh?
We didn't really get to spend any time interacting with Grand Junction other than having dinner one night. However, those other places, Boulder, we spent 2 days in Boulder, 2.5 days, actually. We made a stop at Blackhawk for a few hours on the way back, and they are markedly different towns. They couldn't be more different. One of the things that struck me about it is that the city tour sounds on its face kind of ridiculous. You're going to take 70 people from a small town in Utah, and you're going to invade some other town in the West for 2 days, and they're going to drop everything they do and educate us about what they do. You'd have to say, who's going to do that? But the fact is, I think the city tour is so professional and dedicated to its mission of learning other cities that the cities that host us have a good experience as well. They're impressed with our dedication and our mission, and they want us back. So I think that's that aspect of being ambassadors for Park City is really an important one that the city tour and the leadership class accomplishes.
Yeah, so Colleen, for you, I mean, your impressions of your visit.
I thought Boulder was very inspiring. They're very forward-thinking and very proactive. And so it was fun to see a town like that. It's a lot different from Park City. They have 100,000 people. So just to see some of the challenges that they have. But what Tom mentioned with the other ones that we saw, Blackhawk was very fun. For those who don't know, it's a casino town. And so it was very fun seeing the difference between those two towns. But Blackhawk is who they are, and I respect that.
Yeah. And then for you, Chris?
Yeah, I had a really great time. It was really an exercise in seeing differences between towns. It was interesting to see Boulder and their scale and their ability to do really great things, both in spite of and because of their scale. And also with Blackhawk, just people who want different things. And it's a real clear example that not every town has to aspire to the same lifestyle as we do. And Boulder had really great things that we can take from, and we can learn a lot from looking at Blackhawk, too. Things we may not want to do and things we may want to do.
Well, we're certainly never going to have casinos. We know that.
Yes.
But let's just kind of start the way back, because that's where these city tours were really started from. It was the idea to find out what other resort towns are doing and, as Miles always said, steal from the best. So if you were to steal from something, steal an idea from what you saw, I mean, what would that be?
I do like their sustainability things that Boulder had in place. I see that they, for example, you know, it was a really great example of having compost and recycling and landfill right on each of their, you know, everywhere there was something to throw something away, they would much prefer you to have it put in recycling or compost. I see part of that as being, you know, probably a function of their scale and their ability to do that and spend a decent amount of money in creating that infrastructure so that it's so easy. So that was inspiring. I heard you mention earlier today about everybody in our debrief yesterday. One table stood up and said, we should make Main Street a walking mall. And then two tables stood up and said, no, we shouldn't make Main Street a walking mall. It was very informative to see a successful one that was great and to see what worked and what didn't so that we can discuss that with more, you know, discuss ideas like that with more, with a more informed opinion.
Yeah. And certainly, I mean, the big difference is because there's a walking area within Aspen as well. I mm-hmm. mean, it's flat. They've got blocks. We have one street. I mean, it's a whole different idea, really.
Yeah. And it's also nice to see the things that made that great, that might not necessarily mean we have to brick it and keep cars off of it, right? There's I can't name one off the top of my head, but there's, you know, there was art along the way and places for people to play and just hang out and sit on a bench and enjoy the day that don't necessarily need to come with not letting cars on Main Street.
Yes, I think one of the things that impressed me about the way they manage their downtown and their walking mall, they very much understand that the adjacent neighborhoods to downtown are a key to its success, that those neighborhoods continue to be residential and maybe a little mixed use with a little light retail thrown in. But they see the locals around downtown as really key to its health. And so they work very hard not only to manage the walking mall, but to manage the neighborhoods around them and make sure they remain residential and local.
Okay. So if you were to take an idea, still, what would that be?
About the walking mall?
No, just about anything you saw. Like I say, stealing from the past.
My particular interest is affordable housing. They have a long-running and very successful affordable housing problem. And one of the amazing features of it is that when you look at their affordable housing projects and neighborhoods, they are a combination of market-rate housing and subsidized affordable housing, but you literally cannot tell the difference one from the other. They have such sophisticated design and planning processes that they integrate very well. Also, their affordable housing projects, again, have a little bit of light retail in there, a yoga studio, a pharmacy down on the lower level. They're integrated really well with transportation. So Boulder, I think, is a great example of a place where they've done affordable housing right. Now, they do have a couple advantages. They've been working at it a lot longer than we have. In a larger scale, that gives them more flexibility. Plus, their property values and housing prices are a little bit more mellow than ours are. They said at one point, we thought we were sky high, and then Park City came to town, and we found out we were only middle of the road.
Well, it's flat there. It's a lot easier to build.
Yeah, I don't think that's a huge issue, though. It also floods there. They have a lot more issues with flooding and floodplains. 4 years ago, they were underwater.
Sure. And how about you, Colleen? Anything that you'd like to see Park City bring back from?
Yes. So I had the opportunity to go in the arts and culture breakout session, and they had a lot of stuff that was fun. Some of them, they have gatherings throughout town for creative types, which I think that's really fun for, you know, artists, singer-songwriters, entrepreneurs. So I think that'd be a great space for us to have. Another one that they do is they do murals and performances in their parking garages to spruce them up and to make, you know, put a little bit more light in the darkness. And then I think the last one that I really liked was they refer to them as art deserts within the neighborhoods that don't have a lot of art in them to do murals on their garages. Which I thought was really fun and just brightens up the neighborhood. And I think Diane Foster really liked that one, too. And I think they're going to bring it to council. So I really liked some of their ideas that they had.
So as we start to plan this art and culture district there in Bonanza Flat, I mean, maybe those were some of the ideas that we would see.
Yeah, hopefully. Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Yeah. So something I found interesting was the Boulder rule for a 10-day break between events. I mean, are we talking the magnitude of Sundance and an arts festival, or would the Silly Sunday Market even be allowed to be held there?
I think they're talking about all events generally, big and a little. And they not only have a 10-day break between events, they tend to stagger their events between commercial-oriented events and community-oriented events. I think they have a bit more space to do events than we do. And so they have more flexibility in that regard. Maybe that's an idea for us. Maybe we need to move some events off of Main Street into other parts of town and stagger them that way rather than by time and schedule. They have a lot of flexibility that we don't have because of their size. they also have, I think, a major difference between the two towns, of course, is the University of Colorado. It's a huge campus. It's very close to town, and there's a lot of interaction between the town and the campus. And even more than that, the campus generates every year thousands of graduates who are looking to start their lives. And one thing they like to do is come into Boulder and look around and say, what's an idea for a business I can have here? What's something I can give to Boulder and Boulder can give to me? So there's a lot of incubation and startup, and a bunch of it's tech, but it's not necessarily tech. I was really impressed with a place called Galvanize, which is a residential entrepreneurial workspace they have that's just amazing.
Yeah. So, Colleen, any other impressions about your trip there?
I just think it's a great opportunity for us to see another town. And as we all know, this isn't Miles' first rodeo. He's done this for many years, and he does a fantastic job. And I know that there's a lot of people who may have applied to leadership or who may think about it in the future. And I cannot recommend it enough, because it's just such a rewarding experience. And I think all of us coming away from it just learned a lot. And also, you know, kind of love our town maybe a little bit more too, just learning some of the challenges that they have and some of the stuff that we don't have to deal with. So,
and Chris, any final thoughts?
It was really great to just see two towns that were so different and so different from ours. And since they both have had such economic kind of success in the past, you know, 5-10 years, they both had kind of moved into this interesting space. You know, Boulder kept saying we have 100,000 jobs for 100,000 people. And then this casino town of Black Hawk that was growing so crazy left us kind of asking at some points, like, okay, what's the point? Where do you go from here once you stop attracting tons of businesses and needing to grow jobs? And what's the point? Is your point open space or sustainability or, you know, housing to make sure that those 100,000 people are doing really well? And there's not an answer, but it was a really great question to ask for kind of any community that's able to get to that point. And that was an interesting discussion that I hadn't had before.
Okay. I'm going to leave it there. I just want to make note, though, Thomas, you've got a bunch of photographs at the Park City Library, I guess, through November 26th.
Yeah, I do. An exhibition called A Mountain Autumn, which is fall foliage photography, mainly from Park City and the West and the world. And it's up at the library now. And this week I'm going a little crazy putting up an exhibition at Red Butte Garden on forests around the world. So, yeah.
All right. Stop by and see it. Okay, Thomas and Colleen and Chris, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks,
Leslie. Thank you.
Well, anticipation of the new demand-based parking system that goes into effect December 15th. Lots of work is being done in China Bridge, which has closed sections of parking now for several weeks. In the studio with an update of how that's going, along with the work at the Homestake parking lot, I have Park City Transportation Director Al Fernandez, along with Kenzie Colson. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So let's see, where are we then with China Bridge? Are we on schedule for getting all that cleaning and painting done in time, Kenzie?
We are. The China Bridge project is quite complex, but it's going very well. We have deep cleaning, painting, electrical, concrete repair, waterproof membrane repair. It's a lot that's all coming together at once. And the rolling closures will continue through the next couple of months, but the most invasive work is estimated to be complete by the end of September.
Okay, and that's with the painting and cleaning?
Correct. The painting and the taping and all the prep work is invasive, and we've been really careful to try to minimize the closures.
Right. So we're painting it white on the inside with then bands of different colors to mark the different levels?
That's correct. It's actually wayfinding via color per each side of the garage. Because our levels aren't exactly flat, it was determined by the experts that we should help people determine the north side versus south side via color. And at the egress points, you'll see an extra splash of color, which will help identify how to get out of the garage, how to find the staircase.
Yeah. So does that paint last long? We're not going to have to do this for a while, are we?
The paint is estimated to last several years, although there will be a maintenance component to this project. We are getting really positive feedback on the side of the garage that's painted. It's so much brighter and safer and cleaner, and we really want that positive experience for our guests.
Well, like we just heard from these guys, they paint murals and stuff in parking garages.
Mm-hmm.
be nice to have a KBCW sign right out front there, too. Brighten it up. Anyway, what else needs to happen? You've got you'll be installing some gates then at all of the entrances?
That's correct. Each entrance and lane will receive a gate. And so we'll see some concrete pads go in pretty soon in the next several weeks. But we actually won't see the equipment and gates bolted down until the end of October. That technology will be prepped and bolted and ready to go. However, it won't be actually in use until our launch date of December.
Yeah. So are the gates going to be down all of the time? Is that how it works?
Upon launch, the gates will be down all of the time. And so even during periods when parking is free, you will take a ticket and interact with the gate.
Now, I'm fortunate that I come in when nobody else is using the parking garage. But as we know, a Friday, a busy Friday or Saturday night, people trying to make a left-hand turn into the parking garage coming up from Sweet Alley. I mean, have you anticipated the traffic jams?
Well, actually, that's a large component of this project is arranging the flow of the garage in a way that will better utilize some of our spots on the south side. And it considers the queuing that we face on Sweet Alley. And so the two most northern lanes on Sweet Alley will become exit only, and the far south end of Sweet Alley will become all entrance only. And this will create a flow where we can utilize not only that south side of the garage, but also the S3 entrance, which would be the one closest to the back of Egyptian. That one has a longer lane. And so our goal is to get cars off of Sweet Alley and eliminate some of the congestion we see. It's really difficult when Sweet backs up and it impacts our transit. So that's a major initiative, and we'll be assessing that as we go.
Now, will there be also a gate up at the top of Marsac?
Yes, there'll be an entrance and exit gate at the top.
All right. Pretty much where we see the gate for the Sundance parking?
It will be similar, just a little bit closer to Marsac.
Okay. And then tell us how this is going to work. I mean, for somebody coming in early like I do and then out of here by 3 or 4, I'll still take a ticket and I'll go out and it's going to be free?
That's correct.
So let's say you come in at 11 a.m. and you work until 8 a.m. or 8 p.m., mm-hmm. You're going to pay for parking for a few hours then?
That's correct. Paid parking is set to begin at 5 p.m. daily, but the first hour is free. And so if you come in during the day and you stay into that evening range, you're still going to get your one free hour, so to speak. It'll be $3 per hour after you receive your free hour.
Okay. And that $3 is the base, and it goes up from there depending on the demand. Is that right?
It may go up. It may go down, honestly. But we are very committed to assessing what happens with this program. And the city has hired a data analyst recently. And that's our commitment to pushing forward, making sure that we really assess appropriately and bring reports back to council frequently.
All right. And then the paid parking goes through 11 p.m.? Is that where? Or is it?
Midnight.
Oh, midnight. Okay. All right. And then as we have in the past, you've sold passes. Are these passes still going to be sold? Or
there will be a business permit called the Blue Square, which is similar to what we've done in the past. It's a transferable business pass where it can be passed among employees of a business to ensure that they have access and can use it for their manager on duty or the person who needs to come and go, perhaps. We're also really focused on a carpooling permit. And so businesses and Main Street employees who find a buddy, all they need is one other person to establish a carpool with, and they will receive free parking in China Bridge. And what's even better is that the technology will allow ease of access through the gates. The gates will essentially open with this type of pass upon their approach.
So there's some kind of something on the windshield that alerts the carpool pass. And again, this is all getting rolled out by December 15th.
Correct. December 15th is our target, and that will ensure that we're ready for the winter guests.
And then what about the monitors and stuff to tell people where are those going to live in terms of how many parking spots are on the green level?
So primarily some of those auto count signs will be inside the garage as part of the wayfinding plan. And so as you approach a junction point or decision point within the garage, you may see a sign that says 5 spots to the left and 47 spots straight ahead. We will in the future see some additional spot count signs out on Sweet Alley. We're working on a monument signage plan. And then some of the overall counts for the garage will be available via mobile app as well. And we really think that will be helpful for residents and guests who are trying to make decisions. And again, this project is about mode shift. It's about giving people the information to know, hey, maybe today's the day I'm going to take the bus.
Let's talk a little bit about the Homestake parking lot, because that's really part of this. Alfred, the city purchased this property out there by the yard to eventually build affordable housing on, but for at least this winter, it's being turned into a parking lot for Main Street employees. We're going to have a shuttle service every 10 minutes. So what have we got happening out there?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's about an option for Main Street and Old Town employees outside of the charging at China Bridge. So we felt that this was a good temporary use since this is an asset that we do control and have ownership in now. But we do want to make sure that it is operated safely and it doesn't impact the adjacent community. So we did put out an RFP to do some temporary improvements, and that really is focused on access improvements, some landscaping, some minor pavement work, improved lighting for safety purposes, and then overall some beautification along the corridor also. And then there's still the long-term objective, as you mentioned, the affordable housing component, which is at least a year to maybe 2 years out. But then also being able to improve the whole corridor along there. We've talked to some of the residents, and I think we see it as a major improvement that needs to occur along there, too, with some pedestrian facilities along Homestake also. It's not the the most pedestrian-friendly right now. Maybe improving the on-street parking and, again, aesthetics and landscaping and things like that along the corridor, too. So we want everybody to make sure that they see what we're doing in the near term is a short-term improvement, a temporary improvement, but there's still that long-term objective that I just mentioned.
Right. Is it paved now, or it's spotty in places, I guess?
That's a good way of putting it. So we did put that in the RFP that we'd do some pavement assessment and see where we did have to do some minor pavement work. For all intents and purposes, it is paved, but there's some potholing that probably needs to be fixed, maybe even a minor drainage work also, areas for snow storage. And then better delineation of the actual parking stalls themselves so people can circulate and they can get in and out of there very well.
Yeah, so it will be getting plowed then regularly.
Yes.
Where's the shuttle pickup going to be?
We'd also put that in the RFP that we would have a temporary transit passenger facility waiting area. So the shuttle would actually come into the parking lot and circulate around. So that has to do a lot with the striping and the circulation and the mapping that we need to do.
So it'll be accessed, ingress and egress from Homestake, and then what, head out onto Kearns, or do you come back through?
Potentially we would look at coming out on Munchkin also, so that's something we need to work on, and we did put that in the RFP also, that would be minor improvements, and making sure that we're also not impacting the Boneyard and other businesses along there too, that everybody's on the same page and that we could access the parcel that way.
So will that be ready to go by the 15th of December?
That is, yes. We have the RFP in, and we would look to get that design work done in the next 3 to 4 weeks. It's very, very minor work. It's really just looking, again, at the striping, some of the access, and then get a contractor on board to do that work probably in about 2 to 4 weeks.
All right. And then, again, it means free parking for those who use it. How are they then getting back? Those shuttles will run till when?
We've talked about running them till, 2 or 3, Kinsey? Making sure that we coincide with we're not stranding people.
We're actually in the midst of a survey with the Main Street business employees right now, and we're trying to assess how late we need to go. Right now, we're prepared to go to 4 a.m. And just make sure that we're capturing all the need.
Yeah, because I've certainly heard that there are people who are there till 3:30, 4 in the morning. So what about then next year? Because eventually this is, like you say, is going to be housing.
Yes. So we would still, the plan is to move along and get the Richardson Flat lot online also. That really was the intent of also of having the campus commuter shuttle in place this year and to build off of that also. So it's really to expand those options for people that don't or can't park into Old Town area. So, and again, additional incentive programs that Kenzie mentioned, such as carpooling, and then even the Electric Express is what we've seen. We've seen a considerable amount of increase in ridership on that bus and on that route. We had 35,000 riders in July, and now we've had, I believe, I have the number right here, closer to 45,000 in August. So ridership's been not only constant, but has also been increasing, too.
Now, has the 248 environmental assessment thrown a wrench into the plans to open up Richardson Flat? Because the idea was to have that bus rapid transit or high occupancy vehicle built, but we're at least 2 years out of that, right?
Yes. I mean, that's what we did build into that environmental assessment, that they would take a look at access improvements to the Richardson Flat lot. The physical improvements are going to be a little bit behind the schedule, but the service improvements are something we want to have in place regardless of having the actual dedicated transit lane. So when I say service improvements, I mean the transit service improvements.
So we'll have a bus, but they'll be in the traffic.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And again, that works really well for people outside of town, but for those living inside, once this homestake lot goes away, will there be another one for people who are in town that still want to have that free parking, or
get
on a bus? Huh?
Yeah, exactly. We would encourage people to get on the fixed route systems. Again, we're kind of looking at reevaluating how the transit system operates. I've mentioned before on the show that we've been very good at the resort-based transit system and serving that population. But again, we're shifting to be more focused on the commuter and the resident also.
And then where does the microtransit fit into all of this?
That would be a larger component to be able to better serve the neighborhoods, and then also potentially shift from that shuttle service that really fulfill that need for the shuttle service that goes until 4 a.m. So not necessarily having the redundancy, but having a different option, a different alternative for that.
Do you expect to have microtransit up and running this winter?
That's a good question. We're going to be coming back to council. We're still in the evaluation process, but we'll be coming out to council in the next week or two with a final recommendation for that. We still think it is a very, very viable model. I think it's a very, very cost-effective way to serve our other areas that we can't currently serve, and that probably potentially overserved in certain areas with bigger buses, that we can bring these down to a more scalable model.
Okay. Well, Kirk, have you worked out anything with the Montage? I don't know if you see people out there in City Hall hitchhiking.
We do.
Up the mountain.
And we've talked to the HR department about that also, and how to better make sure that we don't always cut back on these schedules that we talked about a few weeks ago with the orange going away and the purple going away and being able to fund those year-round also. But it's important to have the schedules, the work schedules that Kenzie mentioned also, to make sure that we're serving the markets the best we can.
Okay. Even having a pullout, I guess, if people had a place to stand to hitchhike might be workable, right?
I
mean, that's part of the problem, is that if you try and stop for one of these kids, that you're stopping traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a highly visible transit waiting area also, where there's some refuge and lighting and safety as well.
All right. And then the red and yellow line bus lines in Prospector. Again, there was some controversy over the change of route of the red line. What's happening with them this one? Are you going to run both again? Or
We're evaluating that right now. Again, we're looking at our tax revenues and sales tax revenues that fund the transit system. We are looking to go back to the HOA group in the next couple of weeks to get their feedback and present alternatives to that group. The service was put back into place last year, and the community responded. We saw very, very high ridership over there, so we want to make sure that we're, again, serving that and then giving them the opportunity to provide us feedback also.
Okay. Guys, anything else you think you need to mention?
I just would like to take an opportunity to push people to the 248 project also. I know there's been a lot of discussion in the community. We do have a website or an email that's called sr248improved@utah.gov, and then we also have a hotline at 435-602-7440, and it's important to use these mechanisms in these channels so we can make sure that we capture everyone's comments and that they're addressed adequately through this process.
And Kenzie?
I just want to thank the community for being patient with our work on the garage. It is an aggressive project, and we're trying to beat the snow. And for those regular parkers and employees, I want to recommend the Sandridge parking lots, which have been largely underutilized during the construction. So it's a really good option if you're coming to Main Street daily.
Okay. During the day, they're great. At night, good luck. Okay. Hey, thanks. KPCW News time now, 8:45. Good morning. Well, in the studio now with an update from the Park City Education Foundation, I have Director Abby McNulty along with Nikki Blumen with Bright Futures and Mo Hickey. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the Bright Futures program. Nikki, last year was the first year, so how did it go?
I actually just joined this year, so I'm excited to build on the foundation that they started last year. They had almost 30 students in the program last year, and we added another 27 to our summer academy this August.
Okay, so we've got 57 now in the program then, yeah?
Absolutely, and these students are all first-generation students, and they are excited to come to our program, and we are going to help them with self-advocacy, leadership, and support and academic services.
Okay. And as you mentioned, it's first-generation college kids only. Of that, how many are DACA cardholders that are allowed to go to school?
We wouldn't know that information. It's not information that the Ed Foundation or the school district collects. So, you know, we can just estimate. But the majority of our Bright Future students are, you know, they're all first-generation college students, and currently they're Latino students as well.
Yeah, and I guess my question there was, I mean, is this program at risk for those going to school with DACA cards then? You know, that they're into it, and yet
yeah,
in 2 years we don't know
sure
what's going to happen to them.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a great question, and I think that that's one of the concerns, you know, all of us who work with Latino students have in Park City is the, you know, concern for the future and if, you know, if DACA is not there for them to be able to have a job when they graduate from college.
Yeah. So how do people register for the program, Nikki?
The program is an open registration, and Rebecca was doing some active recruitment in the ninth grade last year, and the students put together an application, and they told us why they wanted to be in the program. We looked at their academic information, but we did not exclude anyone that wanted to come. One of the most exciting and inspirational parts for me was the application. Every one of those students wanted to make their lives better. They wanted to have opportunities that their parents didn't have for numerous reasons. And one of the things that really inspired me was they wanted to make their families proud. They wanted to debunk the stereotype that they were going nowhere, that they were actually worthy of college education, and our program is going to help see them to and through college. And that was really exciting for me.
So 27, those new 27 are all 10th graders then?
They are.
All right. And then you'll add more 10th graders next year and then move that 57 along plus. So you've got endless funding for this?
we love to fund incredibly impactful, high, you know, quality programs, and this is one of them. So we do special fundraising around this program. So Bright Futures is entirely supported by individuals and corporations who have designated their funds to the Ed Foundation to support this program.
All right. And I guess it's once you've got, it doesn't matter. It's just maybe less time per student is what you've got because you've got the staff in place and the program
mm-hmm.
in place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you can add as long as you've got staff to do it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Currently, Nikki and Rebecca are both part-time working on the Bright Futures program. And eventually it will need a full-time staff person as the program fully builds out because it follows kids all the way to college graduation. So there will be up to 220 kids, right, roughly, in the program when it's fully built out.
Yeah, so it's over 7 years.
7 years.
So do you have a maximum number then? I mean, is that kind of...
We're trying to aim for about 30 kids a class because that's what we can build on right now and plan for.
Okay. Yeah. Let's just talk a little bit about the DACA fund while we have just a couple of minutes here. We had reached the goal of $20,000. That included, Mo, a $10,000 grant from Zions Bank. That's surprising.
That was, well, it was, I don't know if I'd call it surprising. It was welcome. Zions Bank has been very supportive of first-generation students in our community and in the state of Utah. So it was not totally unexpected, but out of the blue when they came in with it, which was great. Abby did a great job explaining to them our need. We'll be registering renewal applicants this Thursday night at St. Mary's from 6 o'clock till 9 o'clock. Any student who's up for renewal between now and March 5th of 2018 has to have their renewal form in by October 5th, 2017. So we really have 3 weeks to get renewals in for anyone who's eligible at the moment. So if a student is need to renew, show up at St. Mary's, bring your laptop. We'll have Simple Citizen there. We'll have Immigration Legal Services there for legal help. And we'll have a ton of volunteers who've already come out and asked if they could show up and help out getting the kids' renewals in place.
So you just have like a debit card then that they can use? Or
No, what we'll do is they fill out their application online. It's Simple Citizen has a great format. Then we pass that over to Immigration Legal Services. They will review it to make sure it's done properly. They'll send it back to the applicant electronically, so it doesn't go anywhere until that point. Once everybody signed off on it, student signs it, we'll cut a check for them because it has to be a check, not a debit card. It has to be done by mail. So our goal is to have every renewal possible finished by September 30th because it has to physically be in the office by October 5th so we can FedEx the last group out September 30th if it comes down to it.
Okay. Now, is this just for Park City School District students, or are you opening it up to Summit and Wasatch County?
We're opening up the process to everybody. We're going to prioritize Park City students, Park City residents. We've had some people from Wasatch reach out to us asking could they do renewals, but also asking how they could donate towards the cause. So if anybody in Wasatch County is listening and would like to donate, they can go to PCEF for Kids, type DACA-Wasatch in the comment box. So we'll know that they're trying to get the money to the Wasatch students. We've also had students from Park City that graduated Park City High School that have moved to Wasatch for work and because it's more affordable for their rent, who have come forward and asked us for help. Few kids in the county so far. We really don't know how many people are going to show up on Thursday night. We're hoping it's a great turnout. We'll continue to raise funds and hopefully get everybody's renewal in.
And do you have another date set up in terms of that?
No, we're going to see how many show up. We picked Thursday night at St. Mary's because we're hoping to get a larger group. After that, we'll open up Swede, Mega Genius across the street, and we'll have weekly renewals or daily if we need to. The goal really is to get every kid in this community to understand that if their renewal comes in that time frame, if they don't get it in, we don't, you know, by the October 5th deadline, we really don't know what the next step's going to be in the process.
Okay. Real quick, Abby, the Red Apple Gala coming up the 16th. It's sold out, but you are offering another way to participate.
That's right. So just so everyone understands, the two programs that we talked about today are programs that are funded by corporations and individuals who specifically want to fund those programs. And the way we raise money to support our 100 other programs within the school district is through our events. And one of those is the Red Apple Gala on Saturday, September 16th. And it is sold out, but if people are interested in continuing to support the work of the Ed Foundation or want to get a piece of the action of the gala, they can buy opportunity drawing tickets for an electric Pedego bike for $50. They can buy them on our website at pcef4kids.org. And we also have parties that we sell as part of our Red Apple Gala. And the tickets for the parties, all the proceeds go to the to the Ed Foundation. They're hosted by different volunteers throughout the community. And we have four parties. Those can also be purchased on our website.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
KPCW. Well, as we've reported, the Wasatch County Fire District proposing up to $1 million tax increase. In the studio to tell us why he thinks it's necessary, I have Fire Chief Ernie Giles. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you hosted an open house last month inviting people to come see what you do, showing off some of the equipment that's involved. Did you have elected officials attend?
That's what we had, was all elected officials from the eight cities and townships that we protect besides the unincorporated areas of the county.
Okay, so you wanted them to have a firsthand look of what you do and what it costs to do it?
Correct, yeah. Show the cost of our equipment and the lifespan of some of that equipment.
Yeah, so tell us why you need $1 million.
Well,
$1 million.
Yeah, well, the proposal, the motion was from 750 to $1.5 million, and we're looking, EMS and fire currently right now are different entities, and they're looking at putting EMS under the fire district, and we actually currently run EMS in Heber City from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 7 days a week. So if we do combine those, we're going to need to hire probably 6 to 8 full-time personnel to actually offset it because we're just wearing our volunteers out. It's just they can't leave their jobs 3 and 4 times a day and for 3-4 hours, and it's just hard, and we're just to that point to where our call volume is so high.
Yeah, the call volume has, I had some numbers earlier, I mean, jumping from about 1,900 calls 5 years ago to more than 3,200.
Correct, yeah, and that's hard to run it with a volunteer department, partially volunteer, and it's just to the point our county with these eight towns and cities and townships, it's hard to keep up with it all.
So now why does the Wasatch County Council have to approve it? You don't, as a district, have taxing authority?
We do. The district has taxing authority. Back when we went from a commission to a council, they voted to be the administrative board over the fire district. So the county council literally is the council over the fire district.
Okay. So Truth and Taxation is held at the Wasatch County Council meeting, but they're acting as the kind of fire board?
Correct. Yep. Yeah. And then they have to approve it. They're the legislative body, and so they have to approve, you know, any tax, whatever it's going to be, you know, and our equipment to get back to why we need some of this. I mean, our average age of our equipment is 1992. So, I mean, they're extremely old. I mean, we've done a great job of keeping them up and trying to, you know, do the best job we can for the taxpayers and stretch the dollars. But it's time now that it's so busy we just have to update our equipment, and they're expensive. I've ordered a new ladder truck. It's an aerial and has a pump on it. Time we get it equipped, it's going to be right around about $1.1 million for one engine. So they're expensive.
So what is your annual budget?
To kind of back up and give a little bit of a history of the budget, the Jordan L. Basin had an assessment set up there, and that was done in 2000. And it was done by ERUs for a number of years. And in 2009, there was a lawsuit brought that they thought was unfair that those folks had to pay more than the people in the valley, but they had a full-time station there. So anyway, to fast forward and not bore you with all the details, the assessment ends this year. This will be our last year to collect it, and it generates right around $650,000 out of the Jordan L. Basin besides what they pay on their county tax. So that's going to be eliminated. So right there, we're $650,000 short for our 2018 budget. And fast forward of where we need to be to try to buy equipment, we went after a tax increase in 2013 of $600,000, and $300,000 of that was to be set aside to buy new equipment, and the other $300,000 was for operating and wage. So now we're to the point where the $300,000 isn't catching us up on equipment. It just isn't enough. I mean, I've saved that. We've paid for this ladder truck. We didn't have to finance it. I've had that set aside in the bank and paid and saved us quite a bit of money where we paid for it. And so the council realizes what, you know, we have to go through to get to this tax increase. I mean, like I say, we're $650 down before we get started.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's when we're talking about how much taxes would go up, I think I read about $8 a month on a home valued. So
to generate about
so one. So less than $100, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, when we went after it before, we hadn't went after one. We've went after the one I'm talking about in 13. In the last 30 years, that's the only tax increase the fire district has asked for. And it's just the point where, you know, a 92 model engine just isn't reliable. In fact, one of our new engines, we went on a call just the other day, and it wound up breaking down. And so we were down two engines. And, you know, Park City's been gracious when we've needed them. They've been over there to help us. But there comes a point in time when you have to take care of yourself, too. So,
okay. I need to leave it there. Ernie, thanks for coming in.
Yeah.